Can we then move to item existing properties with the somebody projector and the laptop you already use.
Okay.
So the owner of this laptop is not here. Okay. We can't figure this one out.
Okay.
I can receive on the basis of the handout from my ears now.
I don't remember how much it will be
there. Yes, yes.
Okay. Right.
And thank you for the opportunity to present to the Standing Committee on Appropriation. I'm Lynette Kennedy. I am a GTAC unit in National Treasury, and for the past 3 years I've been working on a set of performance and expenditure review for National Treasury and for the body of work within government. The performance, the presentation in front of you, it's a short presentation, it's your one about 30 minutes. The idea is that there are three sections that I'm going to be talking to. It's going to be an introduction, a sort of background to what the performance and expenditure reviews are about. Then there's a series of some of the findings. There's a number of slides on the findings of what we've seen in your work over the past 3 years. And then just a short conclusion, and then of course I'm very happy to answer any questions. So to start off with, we are just trying to say what happens, why did we start the work with the set of performance and expenditure reviews? And it starts off with a set of questions that we need to answer. Starting off with, on the one hand, the government needs to understand progress of policy, specific policy initiatives, looking at program performance, also understand the full cost of those policy decisions. So looking at sort of the expenditure analysis component that needed to be answered. Then the very specific needs around cost modelling, evaluating policy scenarios for what is the uncertain future. And we ended up with a system where we had developed processes around modelling, specific policy parameters, and we could then work out a number of possible futures, and the number of ends about how many models one can have. So, what are we trying to do here? We are trying to kind of fiscal consolidation. We know that we are at the moment in such a process, we are in that phase in our country, yet we still need resources. And part of what we need to now do is to find greater efficiency in the delivery of those resources. A better understanding of what are the appropriate mixes of policies and what are our choices within that, as well as looking at existing programs, trying to understand what are the savings that could be found and the efficiencies that could be found within existing programs. Also going forward, we've come to realize the methodology and the approach that we've followed will be very important to allow us for savings, to allow us to have a greater insight into what could be possibly savings going forward. It's also quite clear, and this was a joint project initiated with the Presidency and National Treasury, DPME in the Presidency, that we need rich and detailed information, that the information base of discussions that we need to have, the information base of the type of budget preparation and budget decisions that we need to have, is what we needed to get more clarity on. And the process was therefore launched in a way to answer some of those questions. I think, Madam Chair, my presentation is back up and going on the first one. The way that we organised these performance and expenditure reviews was initiated as a joint project between National Treasury and DPME and the Presidency. The topics that were chosen have been identified both out of a number of sources, but starting most importantly with the National Development Plan, looking at the issues identified there. The Minister's Committee on the Budget would identify certain topics to look at in more detail. The medium-term strategic plan, ask certain questions and require that one has more detailed knowledge around some of its proposals. Also, there were some topics identified by senior officials from both DPME and the National Treasury. The process of organising these performance reviews was very closely working with the relevant departments. Each individual CER has an oversight committee. So we were running 25 oversight committees over the past 3 years. that consisted out of national treasury officials from the public finance side, departmental representation from the relevant department, as well as from the employee in the presidency. The body of the work was done by specialized consultants, such as deep sector experts and modelers. It was done on the basis of an open tender that had been appointed. The oversight committee was also the evaluation committee for all of these bodies of work. We developed a standardized methodology, and that in a way became a breakthrough in terms of the time and cost associated with this type of work. Internationally, a body of work like this, a single PER can take something like 18 months, and we've brought it now down to a 5-6 month period, which means that there's much less cost and much quicker answers as well. Very importantly for us is the question about how we assure the quality of the work. There's a very intense management process. There's basically weekly report backs, but it's very collaborative. We have participation by the departments that are relevant to the project, and we have signed off by an oversight committee, by these oversight committees at various stages before the meeting. So we're always very comfortable that anybody around the table at that point agrees and concurs with the data in front of us, with the analysis in front of us. Because each stage of the analysis is a foundation for the next stage. We have to be very clear. This is pretty much the international approach. We have just made it very applicable to our own localized condition. In 2014, we conducted a review of this methodology. We have a panel of international and local public finance experts on the performance of expenditure review. And they assess our methodology as quite strong and robust, and they are comfortable with what we've been doing. They made some very pertinent proposals on how we need to proceed with making savings, and proposals around how we need to suggest more clear communications on cuts can be had. They also, as we have proceeded, to work around institutionalizing these performance and expenditure reviews in Treasury. We've developed and delivered an in-house course for approximately 70 staff in National Treasury. It will now become part of the routine work of public finance in the future. And we plan to roll out the work that we've done here at the national level to include it to the provinces. And indeed, we're starting with the next phase with provincial treasuries as well. Each PER comprises a summary report, a technical report, an expenditure, and or cost model, sometimes both, as well as a detailed program and policy analysis that are presented in the large frame format. And all of that is available on the GTAC website now in the future. Just to quickly, I won't go into great detail here, but just to sort of summarize, is that our methodology first of all is the ability to make use of readily available information that already exists in government. And this has been quite a cost saver, that we don't have to go and collect any of this information, but that it is available in our various transversal systems. It basically boils down to a detailed period of 2 months around program and policy analysis, where we understand who's doing what, what's the role of district officers, who's got what policy decision control, what are the operational processes in this environment. Quite a detailed, lengthy working process around that. We then move on to expenditure analysis and the building of cost models that allow us various scenarios from the policy parameters. And here we draw very strongly upon our basic accounting system, as well as our per cell, the payroll data on citizens in government. Of course, the devil lies in the detail, and that is a very short summary of something that takes 6 or 7 months. And it's much more complex when you really put these systems together to try and understand what it is, what are the unit costs for certain activities. Here's the list of the completed PERs. I think that has also been sent through earlier. We have also made all of these and published ones available on the GTAC website, and are happy to answer more questions around any more details of them. I'm going to discuss them in these broad categories that we have. I'm probably not going to talk about each and every one of the 25, but I'm trying to bring out the highlights of the most important. I'm happy to answer any questions that some of you might have. If we start looking at the urban space, I think one of the first things that we noticed in our study is that we have made significant progress in providing formal housing. Only 20% of the population are living in non-formal dwellings by 2012, and this includes traditional dwellings. The subsidized housing is a key element of the South African social contract. It's quite clear to us. And we could pick up in our study that in the RDP house specifically, 370,000 units have been delivered between 2010 and 2012 for a certain amount of money. The unit costs of the RDP houses are greater than the value of the subsidy. The value of the subsidy for an RDP house, and it does mean that therefore there's an additional burden on the finances of local governments. We are seeing from our numbers that the delivery is somewhat lower than previously reported, both for RDP housing and for informal settlement upgrading projects. We believe that social housing has a big role to play. The study that we've done there is quite clear that the expectation around the policy for social housing, pertinently specifically, an important role to play in the restructuring and densification of our urban spaces. We could find 80,000 units delivered in 59 projects from 2007 to 2013-14. The process of social housing is to provide subsidies to attract private investors into the provision of affordable rental accommodation, but unfortunately we could see that private investment has been trivial, really has been negligible to a large extent. Part of the reason that we could understand is that there's been a failure to raise the value of the subsidy with inflation since it was pinned down in 2008. There's also a failure to adjust the income bands for targeted households, making the rent increasingly unaffordable. We have a great concern that we could see that the investors are concerned, the people that you want to attract into the social housing space, that they could not raise rent or enforce eviction orders if needed, and therefore have stayed away from the space, unfortunately. We note in the urban space further that our transport is very expensive, that South African cities have a very low density compared to just about any other city in the world that we look at. Long commutes, high transport costs, and a very expensive public transport sector that requires significant subsidies of, in this case, 27 billion by 2014-15. Almost 66% of the public in the urban areas make use of minibuses. Minibuses only receive 2% of the subsidies towards public transport. On the whole, 55% of the subsidies go to Prasa, mostly for recapitalization, 4% to Gauteng, and 36% to bus transport, both municipal bus transport and the longer provincially funded bus transport system. Transport is in a way a lag on housing. The decisions of housing influence the limitations of what you could decide around the policy space in transport. And clearly changing the demand patterns, having more spatial densification along specific routes perhaps even, is one of the answers to what you need to do to bring down the cost in public transport. Taxis are competitive despite the lack of subsidies because they are more flexible, but it should also be noted that they are also avoiding some of the costs associated with the more formal transport environment and therefore are cheaper. It seems that the new rapid transport systems are popular, but are also much more expensive than anticipated, and those costs seem to be escalating. There's a clear problem around the fragmented management of public transport that reduces the efficiency of those decisions. It seems the different modes of public transport, the decision-making authorities are residing in different spaces, and therefore it doesn't necessarily form a coherent decision and the policy direction. In the rural space, we looked at Mafisa, land restitution, and we also looked at some of the biofuel projects. I'm going to talk about these two, Mafisa and land restitution. There was a 1 million rand program to provide microloans to small-scale farmers through a system of financial intermediary. And the interest on the loans was pegged at 8%, it was not a floating. It therefore means that at that stage it was lower than the bank interest rates, but at the moment it is comparable and perhaps sometimes even a little bit higher. The intermediaries carry the risk of the default, and when we modelled approach, we came to the conclusion that it is perhaps even a little bit flawed, because the intermediaries can only survive at a default rate of less than 5% of the people to whom they give the microloans, and that might not be a realistic approach in the agricultural sector where default is high for these type of things.
Mafisa
also seem to be competing with other grant instruments, so that in one area somebody could be taking a Mafisa loan or expected to pay it back, whereas a neighbour would be getting a grant for exactly the similar policy, a similar need. Treasury withdrew the Mafisa funds, and we're waiting for, and we were still waiting for repayment of some of the outstanding loans. But in our problem of intermediary, but in our estimation, that is going to be unlikely. It has also to be said that the study points to some unexplained large transfers of money to specific intermediaries outside of the Mafisa region. In land restitution, we looked at the expenditure to date. We understood that up to now there's been 29.3 billion expenditure. That has settled approximately 85% of the 60,000 claims that's been lodged. 92% of all of these claims were finalised as financial compensation, and a large 87% of the claims were in the urban area. There are therefore now three components that need to be costed going forward, and which we did. Two components of the backlog, as well as the estimated costs associated with the opening of a new window. The two components of the backlog are, and it's a little bit technically complicated, but there's a component where the research has been completed, the claim has been awarded legally, it's been settled in their terms, but the transfer has not occurred, the legal transfer has not occurred. It's on the commitment register of the Commission, and the cost associated with those commitment register, the work has been done, it's just waiting to have the legal transfer deed at 4.8 billion. There is also a set of outstanding claims from the previous window of 8,700, which is mostly rural claims, and therefore a little bit more expensive than the previous claims. In our estimation of the areas that it occurs, the number of hectares, etc., it seems to be estimated around 16.9 billion. Then there's also the third component, which is an estimation around an in-house study that the Department of Development and Land Institution had done on believing that there will be 397 new claims and at a cost of around 230 to 260 billion is our estimation. So these numbers were given through. I move on to higher education and training. What we saw here are a number of studies, as you can see in the list, there was quite a few studies in this terrain. Just as a background, just to understand that we have 50 colleges and 26 universities. Of course, all these TVET colleges have got a number of campuses, so you know, as entities, there's over 100 of them. At the moment, in our higher education and training, or post-school education and training space, there are 7 million enrollees. Is an expenditure of nearly 80 billion, of which 70% is funded from government. This also consists of work-related training, where we have both funding through the flows through the school development levy and through the various TTAS, as well as the NSF, of about 13.8 billion in that system. And we could find evidence of about 1.7 billion in the community colleges. There's been rapid enrollment growth in the last 5 years, and to meet the National Development Plan and the White Paper on PCEP goals would require even more rapid growth, and we show some of the numbers there at the bottom of the, in the table at the bottom. It's interesting to note that the TVET colleges, the growth between 2010 and 2014 has been 96% in enrollment. And at universities, the growth has been 9%. in more detail. We then looked at specifically TVET colleges. I have to note that the data to access, the access to data in this sector is complex, but from what we could find, and we had to work on a sample basis, and based on literature that's available on the broader sector, there are now 700,000 students in the TVET colleges. That was in 2014, sorry, when the study was done. It's grown, it grew from 360, as I've mentioned. The expenditure in the TVET colleges is largely from government. It's 85% through the institutional grant, through the NSFAS, as well as some funding that flew to the TVET colleges through the NSF, the National Student Fund. The National Development Plan goal is to have 2.5 million students by 2030, and the question, of course, has to be raised that can schools deliver these students to go to the TVET colleges. The throughput rates at the TVET colleges are very, very low, and it's a point of great concern. And there are some questions about the value of the TVET qualifications in the labour market. The link between local TVETs and their industries is something that needs to be strengthened, it becomes quite clear. At universities, the enrollment at the moment stands at 669,000, also a strong growth in enrollment, and graduates at 189, up from 88, 13 years earlier from the data that we've got here. The funding at the moment from government has grown at an annual growth rate of about 11%, which is faster than the enrollment rate is, if you remember the 9% enrollment rate for university students. Proportionally, the structure of the funding from government has changed, so that the subsidy grant as a proportion has become smaller, but the NSFAS as a proportion has grown. And there has been real growth as well in the general funding for universities, in the subsidy for universities, the subsidy grant, the various grants, but just as a proportion it has reduced against the NSFAS. And student fees have been increasing, obviously, as we know, in the country at the moment, reducing affordability. At the moment, NSFAS loans have grown from 6% to over 30% of all fees, and it varies quite significantly between universities. There are some of the universities where that is up to 40-60% of all fees are covered by NSFAS. Pertinently in the NSFAS study that is available, I just need to say that this study was done just before the recent changes in the NSFAS environment, so it's a historical view of what was the case at the point about 2 years ago. It's the beneficiary numbers that we're looking at here are around 425,000 beneficiaries. Do remember that about 90% of the students at the TVET colleges receive an NSFAS grant, not a loan, but a full-on grant, and then the rest of the NSFAS is go to the universities. The key issues for NSFAS is that the funds are spread very thinly across qualifying students, and it reduces the ability to prioritise. Therefore, it reduces NSFAS's ability to prioritise specific students and specific study areas. Key issues for NSFAS is that the average value of the NSFAS award is lower than the full cost of study. That's in the case of universities especially. There's a very low repayment rate to NSFAS, it's below 5%, and therefore it's depriving NSFAS of necessary funding to on loan again to new students coming into the system. Obviously also NSFAS has a cut-off for eligibility, income cut-off for eligibility, which means that there's a whole group of middle-income students which are not eligible for NSFAS. The key conclusions out of the number of studies here on the higher education and training is that we have very ambitious targets in both the White Paper and the National Development Plan, and we need to take cognizance of the expenses associated with that. A key driver in the sustainability of the school education and training sector is raising the throughput rates. We have very low graduation rates, both in the TVET colleges but also at university, which means that it's quite a significant drawdown on the resources just to keep a student in the system for about 6 years instead of the 3 to 4 years on which I'd really like to see. There's a recent study by the Council of Higher Education about a slight increase in throughput universities, but still we are in the middle 60s in terms of throughput rates at universities, and that is a significant drain on resources. I'll move on to the economic development studies. There's been a number of those as well. Perhaps difficulty so, autism could also sit with education. Let me start with that one. We did a study on the production of artisans. What does it take? What does it cost to train artisans? It is not an inexpensive training. It requires small classes in the theoretical and practical lab component. It requires one-on-one leadership. What we could see is that we spend as a country in 2014-15 about 6.5 billion rand worth of the whole system cost 6.5 billion rand. The costs are shared between government and employers. The cost per artisan at that point was about 450,000 rand. Not an inexpensive training to become an artisan. The throughput rate, again, is very low. Only 57% of the cost of people that it is 57% throughput rate. Again, the curriculum, like the team of colleges, can do with enforcement. There's a concern from the state, from industry, that artisans are not being trained in their needs. We discovered that the system is incredibly complex, and if it's complex for us, I mean, it must be very, very unfair towards, well, not unfair, but it's very complex for a student to negotiate the system. There are up to 13 different routes on how to become an artisan, with a lot of overlap, a lot of duplication. We find that at the moment we are training about 14,000, 15,000 artisans. The goal is to train, the NDP goal is to train 30,000 artisans per year by 2050, and increase the spending, estimated spending that we've done from the current 6.5 to 50 billion in 2030 in 2014 rand. In real terms. We also looked at CEDA Technology Incubators, and this seems to be a very well-designed program. There are 28 centres supporting firms in many, many sectors. If measured by the failure rate after 3 years of incubation, which is an international norm, we are comparable to the international failure rate. We do think, however, that this program has lost a little bit of its focus on the technological component, and I think in many ways, in technical language, this is due to some of the perniciousness of indicators. They had to start reporting on something else but their main goal, and it was a little drift. Under economic development, we also looked at the effective partnering between science councils and the private sector. And it's clear that it's not been a sufficiently explicit policy objective, and it might not always be appropriate for all of the science councils. It depends really on the extent of partnering. It depends on a number of factors. Well, the effort exerted by the science council, which is what we want to measure, the nature of the industry in the mining space, the maturity of the mining space allows science council like MINTEC to partner much more effective than the type of structure that you would have in the pharmacological environment. So on average, what we see is that our private investments are worth only 72% of government investments, and this is largely, this average is largely drawn up by the MINTEC of 171%, and the CSIR, which is 104%. For the rest of the science councils, and some of them are processing, so you don't really get much private sector involvement. One of the first studies, small little study that we did, was on industrial development zones, and it's quite clearly there's high cost involved in here. There's 10 billion rand in infrastructure spending, and this is the model that that you would be extensive infrastructure built. 70% of the 10 billion was spent as cook-up, versus a private investment that could be attracted for about 3.2 billion. There were a few full-time jobs created, but 5,000 jobs is not, you know, is reasonable. These are very high operational ongoing costs that were really sunk in infrastructure, but what is noted is that there's really high operational costs and high operational losses of about 400 million per year in the 3 years that we looked at. And the idea was that this should be informing a new SEZ model that is moving away from an upfront high investment cost in infrastructure, but to sort of move towards a more off-budget investment incentive that would require, we believe, very strong monitoring to prevent perhaps a similar situation from the legacy. We looked at an integrated nutrition program. This was specifically for the presidency, based on a body of work that they had done. It's been needed to understand some of the cost drivers more appropriately. What we note, obviously, is as we know in South Africa, our malnutrition is high relative to comparable countries. We spend about 10.3 billion on nutrition-related programs, mostly through social grants. There are 18 programs across government. It's difficult to say not all solely for the needs of children, but there are 18 nutrition programs. And on the rough estimation, it seems that the current spending is 50% lower than what is needed. We try to look at costs around provincial roads. Here we have a data access problem. Our normal approach of having a detailed policy information at the national level didn't work. But what we could find so far, and we're going to go back and redo this in a new approach, this study, to find the data, more detailed data. So of the 270,000 kilometres of provincial roads, most are unpaved. Undue delay in maintenance of roads are very costly, and we now understand that in a much better detail than previously. There's a national grant of 9.3 billion to provinces to maintain the roads. It is based on a formula, but we need to get a better grasp about how to compare unit costs on roads across provinces based on climatic conditions, topography, the quality of the roads. You know, there's a whole classification system that we need to get the data in more detail. Unfortunately, not one of the more successful studies. Practically, at the second last slide, I am the second last slide, practically at conclusion, just a few remarks on some of the studies we did in the administrative environment. We looked at the cost drivers in foreign missions, and we noted that the rate of growth in the annual expenditure has exceeded the rate of depreciation of the currency. It seems that there's a specific way that we are calculating our cost of living adjustments that has resulted in our cost of living adjustments being very high, higher than those paid to the US staff, and 60% higher than the US staff, and 50% higher than the UN staff. Subsequent study, Department of International Relations and Cooperation has started to look at this. Unfortunately, or fortunately, as it is in labor law, these are negotiations that have to go back to central bargaining chambers and sectoral bargaining chambers, because the agreement on how to calculate was pinned down there, and we have chosen a route that is not international practice. In a sample of about 1,000 leased office accommodations for national government, it's a sample that we had to take. We had the square meterage associated with that sample. There are about 2,000 leases. We had a sample of 1,000 of that. In that sample, 60% of the leases were 45% above market rates. And we could see that it's quite a concentrated market, with more than 50% of the leases being in Pretoria, and of all of the leases, 7 tenants hold more than 50%. So a renegotiation proposals are in the study. We note we did a study with the Department of Arts and Culture on the various programs promoting language diversity, and there's large overlaps in three of the bodies that work with land use diversity, and we find that in a way there's a very disproportionate share that is spent on administration. In the case of the Pan-South African Language Board, 75% of their budget is spent on corporate services and only, you know, a smaller portion therefore on program activities. We looked at quite an extensive study, but very, very technically process-orientated study about the registration and the monitoring and evaluation work around our social welfare NPOs. And we were able to show them that their present regulations are very expensive, that's promulgated, and that we were able to show them scenarios that reduce the cost of those regulations significantly by billions of rand, depending on some of the combining some of what we consider to be duplicate processes and actually having a simpler system. We also did a costing analysis, and that is available for the National School of Government on their proposals, and proposed some more cost-efficient ways of delivering the services with small tweaks in these sites. We've done an extensive body of work. There's both successes and areas that need improvement. We are, on a generalized level, able to say that policies are sometimes designed and implemented with unrealistic expectations of available funding. We believe that this type of costing approach, this type of detailed understanding of the policy parameters and drivers, needs to become standardized in developing new policies. We're also able to see that policies that require realignment of government structures are often unable to achieve this. The decision-making authority that sits at different points, and it's difficult to bring it together in a smooth running process. Similarly, the intergovernmental cooperation poses special challenges, but that space is complex, as we understand. These expenditure data and the cost models are now obviously available for departmental use, and we know already that in a number of the departments they are at the basis of decisions about changes, about cost-cutting approaches. It is a methodology that is part of a worldwide trend to use big data sets in a rigorous analysis. I very often give people millions and millions of lines out of which we have to extract the necessary data. And it takes a specific type of skill that we are now able to do this in South Africa. But it also demonstrates that what we do is we start somewhere, and by continuous working there's an improvement. You learn, you do something, you do it better next time, you do it better next time. And that really has been our approach. Reform processes, we necessary to have some of reforms following from these studies, takes a longer time. It requires departments to take steps that evolve both the reframing of policies, changes in implementation modalities, personnel shifts, etc. And those are not things that happen overnight. I just want to conclude by perhaps saying that the parliamentary portfolio committees could perhaps fruitfully engage departments on the specific PERs and their responses to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Yes, and some comments and presentations and very much insights. So all our members are now open the meeting for a discussion. So we reflect and engage.
Thank you. The rise of university too, I think it's quite petty. I wanted to ask you, have the opportunity to look at the rise of university students against the national students. Because as the NSFAS rises, the university fees also rise. To what extent does the rise of the university fees eat up a lot of NSFAS funds to the extent that the number of students which must benefit from I just wanted to raise a broad question. I know that you are talking to the bullet number three, the 18 programs across government, from the institution. If you could explain that part. I thought that the institution is located in the Department of Basic Education, but it says that it is a program. Of course, the social development is one of them. And lastly, the broad question that I want to raise to the team from Rome. Where you are referring only to the beginning of the project. I wanted to ask, if you intend, if you have not, look at the broad national road and rail infrastructure. That would have particular rail under some plans and following cover, that would have removed a lot of destructive elements on the road, particularly truck transport of goods. Where is that problem now? Because I think it is a whole 2010 or slightly before that. But the intention therefore was to relieve pressure on the road so that they have a longer life and less maintenance cost. So you have time to look at that, and then you have to look at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member Travato. Any other intervention. Honorable Member Dr. P, Honorable Member McLaughlin, and Honorable Member Kimpana, in that order. Honorable Member.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Just a few occasions, issues for 17. On slide number 4, the methodology is explained there, and included there is a participation by department. Can we get an understanding or an indication of who are the participants from the department? At what level? Is it one of the clerks, or is it senior management? Who's involved in that representative from the department? Further down in the second last, or the last sub-bullet point, there's a plan to roll out this to the provinces. Can we get an indication of when that will take place? Slide number 10. We seem to have this problem where government gives loans and they are not concerned about when the loans will be repaid and how the loans will be repaid. And here we have another situation where Treasury is waiting for repayment of outstanding loans. It seems, as indicated, that it's unlikely. How are you waiting? Are you waiting and hoping that somebody just comes and says, listen, the money that I borrowed, can I please pay it back? Is there no proper system, predetermined system, where once somebody gets a loan, they sign, and there must be conditions that are that go accompany these loans? Because in my view, that is very reckless. You know, where loans are given and you hope that they get I understand that people must be helped, but surely, you know, if this is the attitude, that's probably why we're losing billions of money on an annual basis. There is also in the page slide number 10 mention about the backlog. And again, this is a serious problem. We, you know, the backlog is growing, and also indicated just below here, Chairperson, is that there are going to be new claims at the cost. But the problem, okay, so I have two questions with regard to that. When is the backlog going to be finalized? Is it going to be made up? And then the new claims, when will they be finalized? So a backlog, and then we have to pick up all this new claims. You see, the problem with that is, as trivial as it might seem, these are people that have been given land which they cannot do anything on or with, because they don't own the land. There's no well, first of all, the claims have to be finalized. And these people are being excluded from the economy. So it's just contributing to the situation that we find ourselves in. So it is problematic. Slide number 13. There have been some numbers thrown around, but in your analysis, we see now that net debt is 9 billion, and we know what has happened in the recent past in our country. Have we done an analysis as to what the figure should actually be? In order to satisfy the needs of the students that want to study and that can study. And then lastly, Chairperson, on slide number 14, I'm a little confused here. I'm not so sure how this analysis is done, and clearly I don't believe the figures that are listed. I'm going to explain why. We say it costs 450,000 for oxygen. Firstly, the explanation given is that there are 13 different methods or routes to follow. How is that possible? How is that done? I cannot understand. We previously had a system whereby you applied for a job at the company, and I don't know what the cost or the share was then, but government contributed a portion, and then the company contributed a portion. I see the estimate. Two problems I see here, Honourable Chairperson. First of all, the estimate is at 450,000 per artisan. Well, then I would rather become an artisan if that's what it costs. I've done a quick calculation. If you look at, recently we've heard that there's a minimum wage now. I'm using that as a guideline. 3,500 a month times 12 times 3 years, because that's normally how long it would take to become an artisan, well, it used to be 2.5 to 5 years, depending on how smart you were. But let's look at 3 years. So if you look at 3 years, that cost gives you under 20,000. Okay? Then,
50%.
Why are you keeping it quiet? So, if government pays 60%, that works out to about 75,600. So how do you get to the 450,000? Well, not you. How the thing is arrived at is a bit beyond me. Unless maybe I'm not competent to figure. That's the one. The other concern I have with regards to artisans is that the throughput rate is 56%. That can't be. Because, again, if I look at the old system, it varied between 2.5 years and 5 years. 2.5 years, if you are smart enough and you completed a certain educational level of competence, which was then an M3, and then you could do your trade test. If you a little slower, then you would have to serve the full 5 years, and you'd be guaranteed that you'd come out there as an artisan. So you'd get either a red ticket, if you pass your trade test, or you get a blue ticket if you didn't pass and you serve it for them. So this 56% throughput rate, perhaps the seekers have something to do with it, but there's a problem. So clearly, if it is the problem with it, if the seekers are where the problem is, we need to relook at it. Alternatively, yeah, relook at it and maybe go back to the old system. But clearly, you can't, it can't cost more than 50,000 to pay one officer. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Honorable Member Adopi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for GTAC for the presentation. I understand that you're just giving us a summary of the results, the summary of other things as well, in a sense, and so every line you've given us should be the subject of many questions, but I'll just try and limit myself to a few things that I understand. You say on slide 2, residents in NTV which need some information. If you do not think that the nation then they also need this information. I just tend to feel that in a sense that there's been almost an attempt on part of residents to keep this information from the rest of us. Yes, I think the pressure that's been applied. Perhaps the need is greater with the residents. Residency and the national changes. I think the rest also need the information of the state of accountability and being able to hold these things to account in terms of our constitutional mandate. Perhaps you can make a comment on that. On slide 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, bullet point says body work done by specialized consultants. Now, this is why I see the word consultants, I see lots of that. Can you tell us what would cost all these specialized consultants to do these PERs? What has been the cost of the exercise in that sense? And then when you say that the project's complete between 5 and 6 months and the international normal is about 18 months, does it imply to me that we may have cut some corners in speeding up the process? Or have we achieved the same result as they achieved in 18 months and in 5 or 6 months? Or we have to give a sort of reduced performance kind of thing in order to meet up the time frame? That's your commentary on that one. Urban space, by itself. So obviously, housing 370,000 units delivered, 45 billion. But this is between 2010 and 2012. That averages out to 121,621 rand each. We now another 4 years on from there. Have you any idea of the current cost per unit of the RDP houses? By how much is it escalated? Because obviously, this is of importance going forward because this escalation factor will keep on being a factor. Can you make a statement I query here? Will it cost for RDP houses greater than the value of subsidy, implying burden on local government? Why on local government? Housing is not a local government competency. It's usually provincial. Local government has to provide the land, but provincial usually pays for the housing. That's you just explain why you say that it costs a burden on local government. And delivery is somewhat lower than previously reported. My question is, how much lower? What are we actually looking at? Slide number 8. On the third bullet point, 55% goes to Prata. I presume that means 55% on government spending on transport goes to Prata. But how much of that 55% translates into effectiveness? How much of the, or what percentage of the plant would the crop provide for the 55% abundance they get? Do you have any idea on that? And then again, in the second last bullet point on that 5.58, more expensive than anticipated. Can you tell us how much more expensive? What are we looking at there? Can I carry on, Madam Chair? Do I still have some time? Do I have any more questions?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
We have a note. Thank you. Just for information, on slide 10, my FISA, your second bullet point, you say the intermediaries carry the risk of default. Can you just explain that a little more? I understand that if money is coming from government and it's being handed over to an intermediary who then does the distribution, and so how do they carry the risk of default? I just wanted to understand what you actually mean by that. Treasury withdrew my FISA funds waiting for your payment. Dr. Fries already has spoken about this, but I just like to know how much are we waiting for? What is outstanding? What's the amount? And again, I explained transfers of large amounts to certain intermediaries. Again, how much would these large transfers amount to? Land restitution. The first bullet point, you say 29.3 billion. Expenditure is set of 85% of the approximately 60,000 land claims lodged. I did some quick arithmetic myself there. And that averages out 574,510 rand per claim. If we're expecting new claims of 397,000, it's going to cost us 2.28 trillion to settle in.
Way, way above the 260 billion
that you quote. If we're going to drastically reduce the amount of each claim, or something else is going to happen, I think the figures are a little bit ambitious and enthusiastic here. I don't think we're ever going to get it for that price. And then, in the second bullet point, two components of backlog. You speak about the legal transfer that might occur. Are you speaking about the transfer of funds or the registration transfer of property in the legal? Maybe we could just clarify that issue for me. I think can I ask one more question and then I'll leave it there? Just a question. On your slide 11, higher education and training, the last bullet point there, spending would have to rise from 2.3% of GDP to 4.4%. My question is just with relation to slide 18, the second bullet point, is this an example of that, where policies are sometimes unrealistic, or have unrealistic expectations of availability of funding? Because here at the moment, for us to double the amount that we're spending, it's just not possible within our current framework. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member McLaughlin. The next one is Honourable Member Mukwanya.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honourable Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. Quite a useful study, I must say. I think the first thing that I wanted to ask my colleague has already spoken to in terms of the burden on the local government, because I was also going to ask why local government. And then under the same urban space issue, the one thing that I would like to just get a sense of in terms of the URI, which is low, and you referred to the informal settlement upgrading project, which is also a challenge. But my question would be, because my observation has been that also there are these informal settlements that more of land invasions, and how big maybe it is, or maybe if you explore that area, because they are invaded, then people anyway are relocated from those invaded spaces. But immediately there are more people coming. I mean, new people come to the same place. I've observed it in more than one place, in a few places. And then in terms of the involvement of the private sector, I always worry about the role of the private sector in terms of, here is in terms of social housing. One often gets a sense that the private sector comes in not really with good intentions of social responsibility, but more for profit. as it also indicated that, you know, they also are concerned that the government will not be able to enforce the decisions and all that for that, and have asked like that. They have, because they have people, but they don't have a literally very, very high way that they are. So it's just by way of really commenting this. The other thing I wanted to speak to is the issue of MAPISA and the intermediaries. Because they are funding small scale funds and the interest is 8%, which I think is quite high, because I think small scale, not just in funds, but they are small scale funds. What can be the reason why they are not able to repay? Is it because of the high interest or because they are not making enough profit from whatever they are doing? Because for them to pay the loan, they should be making money out of it. And they lend restitution. I'm actually going to ask a question because I've been seeing this on the news almost daily the last few days, even after yesterday I already changed the staff. This type of say new claims, we project number of new claims. Are these claims that occurred after 2014? Because I've been seeing that there are some questionable, you know, process around those that came after 2014, after the extension. And further than that, just to find out if that they are still going to be in. And it's an unfair question because that's not a study you did, but that's for interesting. Is there still going to be an opportunity for people to apply? Because they should keep asking all the time. In terms of higher education, the numbers that you see for TVET quality and looking at the budget that they get. I know obviously you cannot compare them with the universities. They are supposed to be cost effective, which is why we encourage students to also go to TVET colleges rather than everyone going to university. The small budget, I'm just looking at the budget of 9.1 billion for that number. I think the TVET colleges, again, it's really more about community. I believe that something needs to be done. Because I think that is not adequate. And then, with regard to the impact of this funding, are we getting value for money? With the number of students that drop out of university and never complete, do you think that this NEF, fund, in its current format, is doing what it's supposed to do? Are we really producing this? Because yes, funding is one thing, but the product is what I'm just wondering about. The issue of office accommodation leasing, when you have a sample of 1,000 leased office accommodation, does government have certain criteria or maybe in terms of office leases as to how, the prescribed amount? Is it because government does allow people to go for any accommodation that suits them, or do we have a limit to that?
Thank you, Honourable Members. Mukwanyana, we now call upon Honourable Member Manana.
Thank you very much, thank you very much for the opportunity. There are only three questions from the staff of 1950. About higher education education. We don't have to be able to see the report as a very
I'm happy to know that you're mentioning that because that's where all things start. But I think as I start to refer honorable members to slide number 2 in terms of what are things, you know, why did you bring the interview? It's more of a general comment, questions that are particular reasons. Because if you look at the intention is one to understand where the resources are going to. And secondly, so that once we understand, then it makes it easy when we do certain experiential recolonization or even cut, then we know where to go to. And then as one of the members can note, that this is just a tip of the iceberg in terms of programs across the whole of government. I mean, we told them it's only 25. There could be thousands and thousands of such programs if you look at the whole of government and provinces and even community provinces. So this what we could only do at a point in time in terms of one, the resources that we have or have, and secondly, this being the first major exercise that we did. And I can comfortably say to you that this is new for DTEC and also for us in the way that we've done it. So certainly moving forward we just have find many other ways of doing this research work. Second key thing in bullet number 2 there is that we say we came to the committee before and indicated to the committee that the current budget environment that we find ourselves in, we chose fiscal consolidation. Now, once you embark on the fiscal consolidation and you have a set type of expenditure ceiling, you then have to look inside in terms of what you're spending money on and ask yourself big questions on how best to, one, have some savings that can identify to expand other programs that could be critical, or even take a decision to stop some programs. So the information here that is in front of us is information that's largely the as-is information. We did not in any way package it in such a way that we have our own view on whether this is the right way or not the right way to do it. But as a start, it is empowering ourselves. And if you, by the way, go to the GTEC website, there are details and detailed text and text of each of these areas that you can go into detail with and unpack in a way that will then call here, and that's the last point I'm making before on assembly. That then will then determine or ask the committee or make a determination that the committee ourselves now today to say it will then be important that we, for instance, only call our education department. They've got many programs, but we only talk NFR, for example, or call social development and only talk integrated teaching programs with the information that we have. And maybe in those one-on-one engagements, we can go into too much in detail, but this is only high level. But I would appeal to the committee that it should be looked at, like the way Dr. Fick was asking, that how can we spend? It's more of what SE. We are pressing, and the information is for us to inform ourselves last year on presidency and treasury to say We could, the information that we have can be packaged differently moving forward. Not that it's not important for Parliament, certainly it is important. But I think as an institute, Parliament can look at the expenditure items and maybe for next year say, focus, do expenditure review on these four areas. Come back within 6 to 12 months and let them gain. So it's more of an active information that we presented to you, and we would be more than happy together with the department, who, by the way, chose to choose, as an example, if you look at public health, they are the ones who chose to take rental accommodation that is 45% more than market rate. It's not better. So you may want to be calling the department and say, Department X, you have decided on what basis, and we can only give data. But not that we are not facing it also in terms of our own oversight goals, as dictated to by the CFM and the Constitution, etc. So, Chair, I thought maybe let me just broadly put some of our initial concern as per the members' approach and questioning just on the table, and then we can then specifically deal with each of the questions. And it's not only the two of us, we've got other colleagues in GTEC who can also help address some of the questions that have been put.
And I think that just to start off with, to make it quite clear that our participation from the department is apart from the DG's offices. We write them a letter, they become part of the process, they send the presentation. It's normally at a medium to high level presentation on the committee. The plan to roll out to the provinces is that in our new tranche of identified topics, together with the provincial treasury, and they have presented to us a set of areas that would like to get more information. There will now be a process in the coming year around including more detailed provincial people. Also in our training rollout, we would like to incorporate people from the provinces in training on the methodology. The issue about the information that should be shared, I think we have always wanted to publish this information. It's just been a big body of work that's ongoing, going forward. It will always be published. It is information that is part of the accountability structure for government and the executive. The constitution, the consultants that we are using and the costs associated with that, I do not want to contradict myself if I've answered a parliamentary question on precise costs. If I could refer to that, I can tell you precisely per project what it has cost. But on average, it's about 800,000 that these studies work. And are we cutting corners? I obviously am open to critique always and need to keep my eyes on am I doing, is this a proper job? We did pull in the top international experts on performance and expenditure reviews, and they were satisfied with our methodology. It is because we make use of existing information systems. There's been a shift in what you can do with this type of work because of the availability of better processing power, to put it in crude data terms. And therefore, it makes it quicker. But it also, if you're doing it in-house, and because of one's understanding of the system, the consultative approach that we are taking, we're also able to do it much quicker than an international body coming in and needing to find the lay of the land first and all of those things. So in that sense, if I can then go to start with Honourable Tobias's question. I want to be hesitant about answering some of the more detailed policy reasons. I can give our observations, but I am not, for instance, an housing expert in the project that we did not claim to be able to replace the knowledge and the understanding within the housing department. so that around issues of causes for the slower delivery in the RDP environment, I can point to a few insights we came to, but I'm sure there's a more complex explanation from the department themselves. Part of what we saw is that there's a very complex process around approval and planning and flow of funds and bringing the whole coordination of this intrinsically complex process around the built environment together. There's definitely some concern around some of the tendering processes, and that's why when we talk about this, and I say that it brings a burden to local government in many instances are the implementing agencies. They receive the funds through the various national, provincial, and up to the local government. And because we are only costing the top structure, the difference between what the subsidy amount is flowing down to the implementing agencies and the cost of what we could pick up with is often carried by the people that are putting in the infrastructure, the regulation system. And it becomes very difficult per project to distinguish so clearly between the two funding streams. But clearly we now know that the subsidy money that is flowing down is not covering the full cost of the top structure. And therefore, you know, we understand that it has to be at the municipal level. The university fees, the rise versus the index fund, would need to go back and answer by looking at some of the technical data that you've got here. But the university fees have been rising at about, university costs, and I'm not sure that's only fees, but university costs and growing at about 11%. We have got very detailed understandings of the NS Plus, and I should be able to get you that technical answer. Perhaps if I can't do it right now on my feet, I can do it in writing. The 18 programs across government, the list is available in our studies. It stretches from, we listed those 18 programs across government in the technical report. A number of programs in the Department of Agriculture, the school nutrition program, I think, Honourable Members, that you were referring to, is not what we were looking at. We were looking at the child, the integrating the nutrition program for children, which means human beings younger than five. And integrated school nutrition will be exactly outside of that group. But most of the programs are in social development, and a large component of expenditure also resides in the Department of Health, dealing with malnutrition and undernourished children. So that there's a number of programs that we list, and I can pull that out for you. Here was interest the issue around the truck transport and the rail transport and the project management between that. It's not something that we've looked at, and it's not something we've considered. It's a bit outside of the ambit of our work, but as my colleague indicated, it could be that there's a specific request around that. I would want to explain a bit about the as on the board then Honourable Dr. Fick, if I can explain a bit about the MAFISA process, and I'm happy to also answer Honourable Browning. The MAFISA intermediaries, the money was appropriated by Parliament for the Department of Agriculture. The money was handed over to Land Bank, a billion rand, and that money was then sent, the components of that were then sent through a of specific arrangements to intermediaries. And those intermediaries were the ones that made the loan, specific micro loans. They were managing specific micro loans. What we're talking about is that we're waiting for the outstanding loans, is that some of the intermediaries have been able to repay the loans back to Land Bank. But we, in our estimation of the default rate of some of these intermediaries, are aware of the fact that they are unlikely to pay back their loans back to the Land Bank. Now, it's not a matter that freely can administer and manage. It's something that we alerted the Department of Agriculture and Fishery and Forestry to, and they take the matter further. these, that's the process around MAFISA.
But moving forward, what we're doing with that program is that the department itself acknowledged that there were challenges in the original MAFISA package because of poor management, corruption, etc. So moving forward, we are engaged with them. There's a program called the Wholesale Finance Facility that they are thinking about and putting together. So we have a new thinking together with the land bank in repackaging how support is going to go. But remember, we also have a challenge because if you go to the Department of Real Land Development, DLRD, there's a grant component that they continue to support farmers through grants. So at the moment, you have a competition between a grant funded approach to support small farmers, vis-a-vis loans. So we have people go towards loans. So, but jointly with the department, both the two departments, we and land bank, we are engaged in trying to come up with some last few solutions on the package, better package, how to support smallholder farmers. So this, by the way, this new approach is informed by this study. In moving forward, now we take lessons learned from the region, how then to move forward, because the region was clear in terms of pointing to the right direction where there are deficiencies in the way the current market is working.
Honourable member, are there follow-up questions?
If I go to the land restitution question by Honourable Dr. I need to sort of perhaps understand quite clearly that yes, it is a war that has been settled in terms of an administrative process of research, of agreement, of clearly awarding it to a specific party, but that the legal deed hasn't, the transfer of the legal hasn't happened yet. And they are called settled but not finalised. And they are on the commitment register, and we know that the backlog there amounts to 4.8 million. The new claims, I think, is that those new claims are claims which the department have estimated. It retook their estimation and said before, this study was done before the new window was opened, and we took their estimation and said, based on, and to also answer Honourable McLaughlin, the cost, the unit costs around these claims are very complicated. One really can't work on averages. It differs tremendously between different areas, agricultural land, urban land. Previous claims were mostly urban, now we can do mostly with rural claims. Cost per district to land is very different, and that's what we did within our model. We've got those costs that informs the model going forward. So those are the amounts that then come out of that. We have calculated the NSFAS costs based on the projected enrollment numbers from the Department of Higher Education and Training. It's in the technical model and it's in the report on the website. I don't have the numbers with me. The study on the artisans, I'm afraid to have to say that it's indeed 13 different groups. It was a shock even to the department to realize that. It does cause confusion and it does mean there's double costs associated with people doing parallel and duplicate routes into artisan work. Great, those costs are there. I mean, if there's technical questions on the model, we're happy to engage and talk about it. But those are really costs. There's also a calculated subsidy. We talked to a number of the CETA, especially the CETA was very forthcoming and supportive of the study and with good information. And I think we're comfortable that the costs we've calculated are there. They don't get paid a minimum wage. The artisans, and so the costs are quite high. in addition, it needs to be noted that they need math and science to be able to enter into becoming a trained as an artisan, and therefore a number of people can't do that. The throughput rate is 56, it's improving slowly, but that's the throughput rate with which they sit, and they are trying to do many things about it, including recognition of prior learning to allow people that have been in the system to also go for the exams and be recognized for possible artisans. But it's a complicated process, and it's the reality of a good artisan. It takes time and intense effort. If I could go to Honourable McLaughlin, the current cost per unit of the RDP houses varies considerably between the provinces. Again, we've got the publication, it's in our technical report. It comes down to about an average of 153,000 rand per unit for the top structure. And at that point the subsidy was 90,000. I think I've explained that the costs are carried by the local government who does the speculation of the infrastructure. I know that the question around the Prasa subsidy and how much they carry is available in our study. It's the first time that we put all these modalities, how many people they carry and what are the costs associated, even that per unit cost. The complexity, of course, is that the higher the capital investment as with rail transport, the cheaper the ultimate transport is. So that the unit cost for Prasa in the long term is cheaper. But in the long term. So it's a complicated model that one has to look at what are the implications. But it is available in our technical report. The Marfisa questions, I think I haven't answered perhaps all of them. Let me try and answer some of that. The risk of the default is carried by the intermediaries because they are lending on to the micro loan to the farmers. And to the food production and the chain. So they are carrying the risk of default. The large transfers is available. We've published the table in the technical report on page 26. I think of the technical report we show some of the transfers that was made to some of the intermediaries, which we don't find clear evidence for the loan scheme component of that. The matter has been raised with our legal and technical people in the taking it further. I have tried to explain about the legal transfer in the Dean's office. I am, as my colleague said, the growth of state and post education and training from 2.2 to 4.4% of GDP is just the representing the cost implications. I think that matter needs to be taken first. If I can address the questions by Honourable Steven Pagnani around her question. The burden on local government, I have already explained that now, that is by inference that it is in there. The informal settlement study, I would like to also point out that what we were looking at, and there is a concern, we were looking at what was declared informal settlement areas at the point in, I think it was about 2010, 2011, somewhere there was a declaration. In the meantime, there have been subsequently many more informal settlements. So our addressing of the informal settlement backlog is an ongoing area of priority. It's also quite complicated because it's far more expensive to address an informal settlement in situ than to create a new greenfield development and shift people across. But there are social considerations which then have to be weighed out as well. I think that I'm going to talk about the impact of the funding on the NSFAS and the number of dropouts is really heartbreaking in many ways. If one looks at the implications for somebody, about half No, I mean, I can't put a number on it, but a large number of the students that receive Elliott Park loans drop out. And in a way, they are in a double bind because now they don't have postgraduate qualifications, plus they have a burden of debt as they move into life. And it's a trend that one has to keep an eye on because we see a growing trend of Elliott Park students dropping out. And one needs to be... we need to look at that in more detail, but I think the whole NSPUP environment is getting a reconsideration and a reprogramming of how they go about. On the office accommodation, these governments have got certain criteria, buildings, winter accommodation gets divided into sort of A, B, C, D grades, and government has to go for C or C, D or sometimes B grade, but definitely not A grade. The government has specific criteria that are all very clearly defined, and the costs are driven by issues like landlords being concerned about regular payments from government, about contracts being negotiated with escalation fees automatically built in, and cumulatively, those add up. It's a whole technical process. The government has not been perhaps as fully skilled as private sector in these negotiations around office accommodation. If I can turn to Honourable Rwanda and talk about the throughput rate. I have to say that we're struggling to get to clarity on throughput rate in the college. We know it's very low. And but there's a whole definitional issue. Do you just take a specific cohort that entered and are they graduated after 3 years, or do you take them and you take them 6 years later, plus you add others that have come in? There's complexities around calculating these throughput rates, but that they are very, very low is indeed the case. As a side study in GTAC, we're now moving with some of the mathematical professors to come to a final conclusion about how we're going to deal with throughput rates. We want to have a clarity. This is the data, and here we are going. We do find that some of the colleges have throughput and pass rates which are below 10% and need to be addressed. The missing middle is that for the NSFUS funding, there's a cut-off of income for the family, and that cut-off at the time of the study was relatively low, which means that people that are salary income earners of a range, I 100% remember the numbers, but I want to say middle income earners are also struggling to put their children through university because of the burden that would require on them, and it's not that the cost of university fees have increased considerably, the percentage of their income, and therefore it's a struggle for them. In terms of the comparable countries that we looked at, I would need to go to the report technically to find out the name, but typically we compare ourselves to other middle-income countries, and I require of the people to bring reports from Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, Chile, and take some things. So that would be considered to be our comparable countries in terms of income distribution most of the time. Around the issue of foreign missions, I'm wondering where I've got your question. I just noticed on foreign missions. Oh, the calculation. There's an international norm on calculating cost of living adjustments that you pay both international companies but also international organizations pay their members when they live in a city overseas away from their homeland. Now, to allow for a fairness, it's apparently based on New York. So when you live in a city that's more expensive than New York, you get an adjustment. And then obviously when you live in a city lower than New York, you get an adjustment negatively, so on the allowance. The basic salary of the foreign mission stays the same, the officers stay the same, but the allowance, the cost of living adjustment allowance. So a city like Oslo is very expensive, so the adjustment upwards. Instead of keeping our initial calculation as a percentage percentage of the cost of New York. If you put it down as a hard number, therefore all the calculations up and down is immediately very high. And I don't know if the math is clear enough, but I could spend some more time trying to explain that. We have taken a different route in calculating the cost of living adjustment than anybody else. And because of that, because that was negotiated as part of civil service, the foreign service dispensation, it's an instruction note from the EPFA subsequent to negotiations with the union. We have made, we've solidified that position. And that calculation now means that it's very expensive.
Just in terms of Robert's question on NSR and its relationship to this disease, I think I want to bring two more components to try and explain what you're saying. I think fees and NSR is important, but also allocation over the years in terms of investment subsidies and also enrollment. Because enrollment shot up almost 2-3 fold in terms of access to universities. Now, effectively, that means NSFAS students who need to qualify also need to cater. But I think what the study has shown is that we have stretched ourselves too wide in terms of trying to take on everybody. And what we also did not do, and this points to the kind of issue that we're grappling with, and this was a good pointer in terms of what that president because there you see that one, the 120 we're talking about remains at 120 for many years as a qualifying criteria. Only now in the medium term budgetary statement is the amount, even the needs of education amount of 600,000 rand sort of threshold, so that your middle student or middle major can be taken into account when you look at them. Because if you are a middle income person and you've got 5 people in this student won't be able to afford. And on one hand, NSF will not be able to take into account or fund all the particular students. So we have understood the current challenges to improve the fees, enrollment, NSF increases, and also the cost structure of universities and something that we haven't actually engaged with fully. Because and also once we talk about the two university directors, the issue of autonomy comes in. To what extent can we kind of get into the university and understand their structure, because they have got an impact in terms of the kind of fees raised, because we don't have control, government does not determine. Unfortunately, that's an area that the Commission for Education, Council for Education is not also in terms of setting fee increases. So when we look at all of these sectors, and vis-a-vis the kind of allocation that we have or make, then clearly there are shortfalls here and there. So what's the question around the cost? If we have to take into account addressing all what that is in the white paper, including everything that students are calling us now for, on, we need about at least 120 billion rand to try, 110, 120 billion rand to address anything and everything that free education paid here. This is over and above the current subsidy level in investing. So you have a problem already. So but that's for another day. But I just thought, let me just flag these numbers. Any modification that you make in the current system, whether you increase the number of qualifying students, whether you are taking because currently you find that at Brit, for instance, the fee will be 120,000. At the University of Venda is 70,000. So we find that at NSFAS and there's a threshold of 75,000 threshold that the NSR set. For Venda University, you are taking care of in terms of your meals, your books, your teaching, everything. But for this, you are short with 20,000 or 30,000 rand. So, but if you have to take everyone who qualifies as per NSR to 120,000 and first, for instance, you also need another, say, 20 billion to address all that across the system. If you have to take into account all mixing major students, up to 600,000, who are currently in the system, you need another 20 billion. So across the system, every notification that you make, you need about 20 billion. If you notice, last year in February, after the discussion with last year, we added about 2.8 billion, 17 billion to MS fund. What the Minister of Finance presented in the medium-term budget policy statement is another 16.8 billion or so. So this number is, will be a constant number by almost there. But if you project for, again, every change that you make, every, it will cost you about 20 billion per year on any of the categories that you want to address across the system. Whether you give students free food, everyone, at universities, including transport, accommodation, books, 20 billion. And then the white paper and the financing paper that we have detected also point to the numbers that I'm talking about. And again, but again, as I said, that's for a different day in terms of looking at that relationship that I spoke about, because there are many factors. It's autonomy issues, it's funding, it's subsidies, it's NFS, and so on. But if you look at the quantum, there's an argument out there that says subsidies to universities have been decreasing over time. But the quantum in terms of intervention that government is making on the TSEC sector has been increasing, because when you look at the subsidies, including allocations to TSEC and including NFR, that is increasing. And that graph remains available only as opportunity. But the reality is that yes, this information is something that we can focus on NFR with the department, with ourselves, with the study and the fact that we have, and with the kind of intervention that we're trying to make moving forward. And also taking into account what demands are there on the table and what the medium term is going to be saying around investment funding and post creation training funding. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just answer? I'm going to answer properly now. I've got the numbers, which is to say that the growth in the expenditure in its funds has been 23.3% since 2010. And the growth in university expenditure has been 11%.
Thank you very much. Member, do you have a follow-up question?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Thanks for the presentation, for the information that you take before. Really assist us to do our oversight work when we need to I want to get a clarity here. You indicated on slide number 14 that it's very costly, you know, to produce articles. But you indicated the 2014-15 6.5 billion cost shared by government. But you never indicated the number of articles that they funded. So which doesn't become clear to us, the 6.5 billion to how many articles. Secondly, you indicated that there is a challenge around the issue of the curricula that needs to be improved. Is there any clear gap you have identified in the curricula and the academic development that you said it needs to be improved? And also, what can be your suggestion to improve that particular part? We have something in mind to say this is supposed to be done. And thirdly, you talk about unnecessary complex for learners on artisans. What is your view? What, can you try to unpack? You say unnecessary complex systems that they are using. Do you have any suggestion of the system that can be used that will allow more learners, you know, to be accepted in the system, you know, or to register in the system? Because we talk about learners and then and you say there is a challenge that doesn't balance the demand and so on because of this unnecessary complexity. Also, I want to check on slide number 17. you talk about the sample that you have just paid for 1,000 liters that you have identified, and you are saying 60% of the 45% is above the market rate. Can I check when this information that you have, the sample that you have, is for what date or financial year? I'm asking this because you talk about 2010, you come to 2014, 15, but this one is just saying it's a sample, but I want to know for what is that sample. I'm saying this because the Department of Public Works is known that there has been no department before 2012, according to the challenges that were there, you know, until 2012, where there is a turnaround strategy. That's why I'm asking this, because now it must not create a mind to say that if the challenge is now, we want to know so that when we do our oversight, we know exactly that the problem of the district is continuing in the Department of Public Works. Because if there is an improvement and we hold to the late, you know, date, it may not give a full reflection of what is happening now in the department or in the government. So that's why I need to know the things for this information. Thank you.
Honourable Member, I think that we are now. Thank you very much for watching.
Thank you, Honourable Member. The number of the occupants I think who own that amount of, I should have put in the slide, either 14 or 15,000. I'll look at the exact number for you. They're trying to push the training of artisans up by 1,000 people every year. So we'll have to get the precise data and the precise finances against that data. At the point of the study of 14 or 15,000, I'll look at that for you and give you the exact number.
We will not contact those that you are not sure of, you start meeting to know anything to the secretary. All those that will ask and are not sure about this, because you want to know exactly when we do our oversight, you are not really things that are not.
Yeah, it's in the, yeah. The issue of the curriculum, the gap that we have identified is that the feedback from a number of the industry players are that people are not adequately being trained. That the training, when people have, there's three components to the afternoon training, which is a theoretical component, a lab-based component, and then the in-service training at a place of work. And that the curriculum that is coming through both the theoretical and the lab-based training, laboratory-based in the broad sense of a technical workshop laboratory, is inadequate to the standards of industry. There's a concern that the Department of Higher Education themselves have acknowledged and worked with us in the report to try and be clear about that. The issue of the unnecessary complexity is around the fact that there are 13 routes into becoming an artisan. And I think if one goes back and it leads to reform processes that were started, specifically sort of reform around the NCD certification process that was supposed to replace at that stage a specific way of training artisans, but were not fully successful. And in a way, a third approach to training options have now been developed. But in truth, all of these different approaches are still possible. So instead of having a clean and clear administrative process where previous approaches and previous regulations are taken off the books when a new proposal is rolled out, that hasn't happened in the case of artisan training. So that there are definitely parallel processes of how to go about becoming an artisan available. The department are aware of these things. With the shift of artisan training into the Department of Higher Education, I think it is receiving special attention. And subsequent to the study, there have been moves on changing that. I think it's best to ask people in the higher education sector around how to attract learners. It is a problem. What we find is that instead of it being seen as a real alternative to an academic course, people complete their academic studies and then try and move into the arts and training. The problem there. The sample of the visas, it's the 2013 information, is all of the information is always on the summary, it's available for us. It's the 2013 year, 2013-14 financial year. We have to use that sample because that's the only sample that we could get that had square meterage available plus grade of building. Part of the recommendations in the study is to say that the Department of Public Works database is inadequate for the management of these information. That in this space, the more information you have, the more powerful you are in renegotiating back with the private sector, and they just don't seem to keep the necessary records to do that appropriately. So for the sample that we were able to look at, we have made available on our website per lease the information of what it costs, who's being paid, is the IT outfit, security, gardening, all of the detail around that lease that included in the lease, extra costs, etc., etc. We also proposed in the study going forward different routes of putting savings in place, which would be a renegotiation of those leases without automatic escalation in tribute, or a renegotiation of the leases back to market rates, or a renegotiation of the leases when on expiry. All of those have different implications for savings. So,
defining what they need or what you pick up on the report, what those leads that is above the market rate signed in 2013, that's what we want to know. Because you may look at the report in 2013, but maybe it was signed before the turnaround started. And that's what we want to check. Secondly, on the issue of the gap that you said, it's because they are not giving them the causes that they are supposed to do, that they can be identified. In other words, this 6.5 billion, we are not getting value for money, because it means to say that the accident goes there, then they are not getting the product that is required to them. That's what we are saying.
Honourable Member, the date at which these leases were signed would be varied. They're not signed all. We just took a sample of existing leases in 2013-14. We certainly, at that point already, there were some treasury instructions about capping escalation costs. But the turnaround strategy in public works, I don't know which turnaround strategy. Yeah, I don't know which one would be the one that we're going to take as the turnaround on the leases. We certainly worked very closely with the Department of Public Works, and they admit that they didn't have the capacity to turn around on these leases the way they stand at the moment. Value for money on the 6.9 billion on the artisan training, I think it's difficult to say because there are pockets of excellence. There certainly are areas where artisans are being trained that are seen as deeply value for money and are valued by the industry, but there are other areas where it's not the case. And I think it's better for the Department of Higher Education to give more detail around that.
That joint is the higher education. What is the need for that? I think skill development fund that was supposed to inspire financial, good financial debt, and then it was extended to 2022. Because that involved the target right now. So they invest. They are the sitter. And in all of these things, I don't know what else exists from the system. They put these things, and government is pumping money into all of these things in an attempt to, you know, to drive skills development and particularly skills that are relevant to our economy. And I'm not seeing that we really have a time. Private sector seems to be also investing in that, but we simply are not moving in terms of producing the required skills. And then there's a lot of, I mean, that 6.5 billion then is a lot of money. And you are saying throughput is. So can we request that as part of your review, you look at everything that exists that deals with this subject, so that we know what we're dealing with in the first instance, and secondly, we cannot continue putting money into skills development and effort. And we don't determine the kind of skills that the economy urgently requires. You know, I always make this example. If you go to News 24, to carry on, the time span, simply tell you that skills are required in the economy. And they specify skills are required. I do something two or three months ago, where a list of the most demanded things in the economy. Now, we simply put money and we depend on God's grace that we will produce the things that we require. And neither government nor the private sector seem to be coming together to say, as we jointly put money into this effort, this is what we want to achieve. And as a result, we don't seem to be able to really account fully for what we are funding. It's just in this area. And it's critical that we do. The subject about university curriculum and previous curriculum is a subject for another day. And it's a very urgent subject.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'd like to ask one question for you. For each presentation, you have very said that in your rely on the information. Now, what I want to find out from you is how you like.
the existing information that we are relying on is quite reliable in the sense that it's from the verbal information. So it's not opinion of anybody else. We augment that by intensive interviews, but we literally go to the back of our system and look at the millions and millions of lines in that. And the back accounting system is really underrated because it's difficult and big to work with. But you could go down to expenditure in a hospital, a ward in a hospital, or per school, or per police station. You can go down to institutional level spending. You can go down to area spending per district municipality. Sometimes in, say, for instance, housing, you can go down to spending of a housing project. And I see the example of civil care extension 4. You really can go down to quite a level of detail. Because it's not readily available to managers in government, they haven't used it. But we hope that part of what we're doing here is to make it more visible to people and more easy to manipulate in terms of data manipulation. It seems the data line is there. We also make use of a new body of work around the personnel payroll data. And again, you can go down to what's the expenditure for a school or what's the expenditure in a ward, in a hospital, etc., etc. So there's great deal of data. If we triangulate all of this data, we even know, although we haven't yet made use of it, that because it's an accounting system with accounts that money flows from government to a specific account, one can even say to whom was the money transferred. So you can know that the housing project was a civil care extension 4, but who got paid for those projects? Now there's a number of projects in treasury to make that more visible to people and more understanding. So we're quite fortunate in the sense of our existence. We obviously augment that with the forward information, which is not always as reliable. And that's where the problem comes in, and we've got to really understand what the formal information is, the sense of data, and all the forms have all of those data. And then to say that the next review of topics we hope to launch will be around the beginning of the next, first term of next year, the end of the last term of the financial year, to launch due to tendering, local processes, and then to start working. We think that the next tranche of the work will take a little bit longer because of the fact that we now know that the provincial road information is not available at the national level. We will have to go and search for it at the provincial level, which makes it a slower and more expensive process. But we hope to be done by next year, towards the end of next year, which will be October, September, October, and publish again in the way we publish these.
Honourable Member, I think that we have now exhausted all the questions. The Honourable Member, the existing court not about communication. Do you have some more follow-up questions? Continue the last end, and then we round up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have the time, I think, if I have further questions, I'll be invited. Thank you.
Well, that's fine. I'm sure you will not have a problem if you submit a written question to the Federal or written
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think to be fair, perhaps it would be preferable if I could have went on the website and looked at what's there. If I can't find the answer there, then I can come
back.
I don't have anything to say that I think what came out of this discussion for the first time was that what it did to us as public finance and the treasurer was to start looking if budget analysts in the division that I'm in should start looking things differently and should start seeing the possibility of digging a little bit further in order for our report to be more informed. Well, the first step, what we have done after these and after having learned, we then embarked on a 3-month focus training course for budget analysis that the team took the colleagues through in a way of beginning to start looking at data differently and different methods. So that I think it's a process. I mean, I think in the next 18 months or so, you're going to see a different type of a score report, for example. That is more engaging, that is more usable in terms of how all our members can play out their role. And also, and it will also require you a way to push it back to us and say we can do more. Because most of the things in our democracy are already developed better. We are starting with the learning curve as we go along. And this was one of those things where in terms of our whole reform agenda, if I want to call it that, from where treasury has been from the 90s to now. This was a milestone in our history. You say we've gone this, now how do we move further and how does that empower us? So in a way that a budget analyst sitting at his or her desk can come up with some information that can empower. So for us, we are excited to having seen the results of this and it can only show the possibilities that are there, and it can only make that it will improve the work in the future.
Be greater alignment between improved resource allocation and positive impact to the life of our people. We take note of the discrepancies between high resource allocation for post-school education and training and the low throughput. Something has to be done there. I think this is one area that as a committee we should focus both into and ensure that there is a turnaround for the development of this country, successful development of this country and the community. The report has assisted us in painting by painting a clear picture of the quality of graduates produced by universities, TVET colleges, and the quality of artisans produced through the network and funding facilities. We are of the view that efficient spending and finance delivery on infrastructure delivery should result in improved skills development and a decline in, the high rate of unemployment. We appreciate the collaborative effort between National Treasury, the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, and other role players in the performance and expenditure reviews of the identified departments. And through this, we have gained insight on where resources are going, the impact made, and what needs to be done to achieve the NDP goals. Maybe you should start to talk to that young. 30 minutes, not 20 pages, doesn't sound serious.
Thank you.
paragraph 3.4, the G in intergovernmental should be a capital.
Okay.
And then 3.5, this assists me here. Doesn't look right. The second sentence is the committee agreed. We had to have done something before we agreed. So I say perhaps propose or something, some other way. Sentence under introduction, the purpose of the meeting, we welcome everybody. That's not what you want, we welcome everyone present. We didn't welcome everyone, we should include that there.
Okay.
And then,
okay.
The third line, the third one, the theta, there should be an S after theta, because it's a policy.
Okay, you know what, maybe let's go and look at forward, we should have an item on the agenda that says adoption on the agenda. Agree? I remember the way. We're not moving, but I really want to see whether you are agreeing or not. Agree?
I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
Maybe I don't know what we are talking about. We are talking about the topic. Why is it not the way when we are make a way coming?
Yeah.
And when you ask us, do we agree with the agenda? We said yes. So why is it on this topic? Why must we have the whole topic? And then, if we can say the agenda of the meeting was on topic, no, I'm not quite sure. Is it important about the name?
No, that's fine. You know what I think we should do, eh? Just after it, okay, help me out.
Let's say, as we did in the area on, let's go back and check the minutes we need to the parliament in particular.
Okay. Shall we go and
normally when you put when you check up and put the agenda
thank you. that they really comply. If there is a cushion of space at the bottom here, that's where you do one thing where the equipment are in the open, you'll be able to keep the fire.
There is two things, and then Yeah.
After this one, let's go and look at it.
No, I just want them to apply their mind and tell us now whether it is a mistake versus a genuine one. Yeah, 28 genuine.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
As you know, on the remember Shoppers College, you know, I think they are like us, because with all the 28 of them, but the 24 of them are.
Yeah,
so
thank you.